Hello, and welcome to Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Namaste. I am in a unique situation right now. I'm in a 19th century gypsy caravan, which is like a covered wagon, but with a bed and a fireplace and a breeze. It's right outside a river and a pond in Normandy, France. What a unique location for doing anything, and certainly doing podcasting as well. It's been quite fun trying to figure out how to set this up, but it felt like it might be important to try to do it here. So hopefully we won't have too many distractions from ducks and the like. So we've been on retreat here for a few days, doing a search or look or study or inquiry into how yoga can help with creativity. And not just creativity as in I'm an artist, I'm trying to be creative, I have writer's block or something like that, but thinking about how is life and yoga one. In other words, how can you live life according to the way of yoga? And it's been, I think, interesting for people to hear and to ponder and to do some exercises that help to figure out how that might work in their own lives. And I think I'll share a little bit of findings and observations and just my own take on some of this. So one of the most interesting things that has come about in these considerations of ours is that you can take yoga off the mat, and that doesn't mean, you know, you can do poses in the middle of city squares or like the kinds of things you see on Instagram so often, but rather that there's in the eight limbs of yoga, a place for addressing all kinds of aspects of what yoga is, of what life is, and that yoga is then a method of addressing it. So in the eight limbs of yoga, you have the yamas and the niyamas as one of the beginning things. So that's a sort of a preparatory practices that give some instruction or suggestions of how to make an action in order to get a certain result. You know, so something like not hoarding, not holding on to things that you don't need anymore, not being greedy for material stuff, will bring you into a state where you don't feel lack, right? So if you're not hoarding things, if you give that up, you make the effort to relinquish that pattern, then the result is this thing that sets you in a more harmonious condition with life. So the yamas are working on that. How do you control certain things that bring about not so great conditions? And then what do you get from doing that? And if you ever want, you could pick up the Yoga Sutras and skip to the section on yamas and niyamas in the second book, part two, or pada two, as it's called in Sanskrit. And there will be a listing of the yamas and then a listing of what you get from each one of them. If you do this, you get that. So that's very cool. And the niyamas are the things that you could try to incorporate more of in your life to bring about a shift, to bring about a benefit. And those are all things that are like purity or self-study. And doing more of those brings you into a clearer picture of who you are and gets the extraneous things to be less distracting, and ultimately helps you to have the experience of meditation. So I'm sitting here on a summery day. People are jumping in the lake and playing in the pond. And sometimes we have to do our work. Right? So there's like a balancing act that we always have to do. So we're using discernment to figure out, like, what does this mean in my life? So for instance, the yamas and niyamas, they often get shorthanded as kind of commandments, like how to live. And that's such a religious way of thinking about them, because they're not someone else telling you how you should live. Rather, it's, you know, if you lived in this way, you would get this result. And if you did more of this, it would lead to this in your life. So it's much more of a how-to manual, like how to do things really well. Maybe like a good cookbook, where the pie that you're going to end up with is your own life. So there's that. And there's this whole thing, asana, that everybody who thinks of yoga usually jumps to first, this idea of like, how do you do a handstand and how do you twist your body up in really crazy ways that, and so that it doesn't feel like you're breaking your knees off like somebody else can do. And the asana practice is so important as a gift, as a tool, because it lets you balance your energy and lets you get your body to a place where it's sort of not a distraction, where it's healthy, where it's supple, where it's illness-free. And then you can live your life without too much concern about your body being in the way. On one end, you know, for some people, that's going to look like, I can do, you know, skydiving now, right? Like some people are just really active in their physical realm. They love to do stuff like ride horses and go running and do gymnastics and something acrobatic in nature, or endurance in nature, weightlifting, you know, playing rugby, stuff like that. Other people are much more sedate by nature. They're content taking a walk, or, you know, if they're going to do anything very active, it's going to be like a slow jog or a ride on a bicycle in a kind of a calm way or something like that. So yoga isn't only for a kind of person. You know, like so many times I hear, oh, I'm not good at yoga, I'm not flexible, or I could never do that, or I don't even care about doing that kind of thing. And the thing with asana is, when done correctly, asana is only about making you steady and strong in your posture, about how do you find balance and health. So what any individual's asana practice looks like is really flexible. You could totally tailor it to anybody, which is one of the tenets of Ishta Yoga, the lineage I teach from. So you have this asana component. So you're doing something that helps you, and there's this classical yoga tradition of asana. Don't worry, no one's getting hurt with that screaming. It's just the water outside is very cold. So some people like to jump in cold water. Some people avoid cold water. I'm now in the gypsy tent. They're out in the cold water, for example. So you might craft an asana practice for somebody that looks very different from somebody else. And all it's doing is getting you into a good state to do whatever else you need to do in your life. The next limb of yoga is pranayama, which is working with your own energy, working primarily with it through the mechanism of breath, because the breath is the carrier of this energy that yogis consider, you know, in the pre-medical times, what is this life force? Because they would clearly see, well, this person's dead and this person's alive. What's the difference? It's the breath. So that was sort of the impetus to consider working with the breath more deeply. And so yogis notice when they practice working with their breath, breathing one way, breathing through this nostril versus that nostril, breathing fast versus slow, that they feel different. So you have that possibility in pranayama of shifting your own energy, making yourself feel more energized, making yourself feel calmer, making yourself feel more in balance. So there's that piece of the practice. Again, it's about living, not about accomplishing postures or about how many breaths should I do for this practice. It's about how do I make my life feel more in balance? How do I feel more energized in my day? I use my practice to do that. How do I feel more calm when I'm upset? I use my practice to do that. So after pranayama, you come into the aspect of yoga that I got to talk about in the trio of teachers a bit, and that's the royal yoga, or the Raja yoga, to use the Sanskrit. And it's this part that it has to do with how do you move from a state of mind that we're dealing with the sensory stuff outdoors, outside, and then also all of our typical mental stuff, how do you move away from that dealing with, that mental activity, that vritti is the Sanskrit word, the constant like twisting and spinning of your mind around different thoughts, different stories, different ideas about things. The yogis made up this method for doing that. And you know, now there's a huge craze called mindfulness in the world, and it's very popular because it's very powerful, and the practice has to do with focusing one's mind and paying attention, and that's a really important step in this Raja Yoga, in the Royal Yoga, in the yoga of what could be called meditation. But ultimately, the eight limbs of yoga end up not in a place of any kind of fullness, but in a nothingness. Like, what is there when there are no things there? And the answer, to take all the drama away, is what is there is only the awareness, only the consciousness, only the knowingness of our own nature, that by our nature, we are conscious beings existing in a realm of experiencing, but at the same time, we always are existing in the realm of consciousness. How do we know this? Who said? If you go through the steps of the yoga practice, you come to that acquaintance. You know it because you're doing it. You pause your normal mental activity and all the things of the experiential world take a pause. They stop spinning for a moment. And you have the experience of timelessness. I lost track of time. We did a meditation the other morning and people said, was that really 15 minutes long? It was like so fast. Right? I've told the story previously of getting on the train when I lived outside of the city and starting to meditate at one stop and thinking, oh my God, I must already be at the city, opening my eyes, and I'd only gone one stop. So it's fascinating. So you lose track of time. You lose the sense that you're in a body. You don't feel your body anymore, kind of like when you're asleep. You don't really feel your body when you're asleep, but when you're asleep, you're not conscious either. So in meditation, you're on this bridge. It's like sleep, but you stay aware. And so in that staying aware, you start to become knowledgeable of what it is that's distinct. What is this distinction between consciousness, who I am awareness, and all of this other stuff that is in the realm of experience, including our bodies, which age and change, our circumstances, which are constantly in flux, and the world at large, which is filled with other beings having similar experiences, and then gazillions of planets and stars and, you know, who knows what. So it's quite a fascinating thing to put yourself in the perspective of being just awareness. So when you do that, you come back into your life, and whereas everything used to seem so critical and everything's so small, just like my life is what there is, suddenly you can expand your notion of that. You can expand your experience to include, at first, even other people, just the people around you. Suddenly what they're going through, you can imagine, is more like yourself, because you've had an experience of getting outside of yourself for a moment. We're kind of prompting that in a way here, because we're all the way outside of everyone's normal life. We're in a different country, we're in a different mode, and it's giving everybody a good chance at letting go of their normal thinking, their normal obligations, etc., which is the nice thing about a retreat. And yet you can do that anywhere if you practice and become skilled at, and just enough skilled at, pausing the normal activity and shifting that over into having awareness, no thoughts. Thoughts come up, you let them go. Thoughts come up again, you just let them go again. There's no doing it well or doing it poorly, you're just doing it. Trying is what's required. So those final steps of the eight limbs of yoga are to take your senses away from what they're normally doing. Close your eyes. Withdraw. There are yoga tools for helping you to do that. And then after that, to concentrate on something. There again are yoga tools to do that. And then to let that concentration try to hold for a while. And this is where many of the mindfulness techniques are very useful. They help to teach concentration. Even asana practice is really helpful for that. It helps you to concentrate on your body, to help you concentrate on what you're doing, so that your mind isn't wandering. You learn how to focus. And I'm constantly amazed at how poor people are at focusing, at concentrating. Even people who do practices, they allow, I'm using that word in the most non-judgmental way. It's like a habit of mental activity, that instead of focusing on what you're doing, you allow your mind to wander or to get distracted by pretty much anything. So you could be sitting in a room and someone could be talking, and it's a very important thing for you and it's even very interesting to you. And then someone walks in the room and you allow yourself to stop concentrating and instead to get distracted over to that other person. Right? Our obsession with media and phones and the like is helping us to practice that kind of distractedness instead of helping us to practice focus. So that's where a yoga practice can come in, one that helps you to concentrate. And I would invite you as an experiment, maybe even as an ongoing practice, to decide, I'm going to concentrate now, so that you choose something that you're doing and don't let yourself be distracted. You know, turn off your phone, or if you're at a lecture and someone walks in the room, don't look and see who it is. Or if you're, you know, reading, don't interrupt yourself, and so on. I mean, you can decide what is the thing that I'm going to try to concentrate on, but the important part is to commit to it, and that teaches your mind who's in charge. It teaches you that you have amazing amounts of power to get things done, to stay on point, to tackle anything you need to do. That's all in the outside, but on the inside, when you're looking for insight, for meditational information, or the quality or state of being of away from the vritti, away from this twisting, spinning in the mind, the more you can practice concentration, the easier it becomes to stay concentrated. Then, when it's nice and easy, you move into the final two stages of the eight limbs of yoga, the first being effortless concentration. Effortless concentration sounds like an oxymoron. How can I concentrate but not use any effort? But it's through practice. As you continue to practice, as you continue to balance your body, balance your energy through breath, live well so that you're not creating circumstances that pull you away from calm, then your concentration is easier. Then your concentration can become like literally effortless. An example of when people often do this is when they go on vacation, so their cares are taken away. And they're sitting out maybe on a beach, or maybe by a river, or maybe fishing, or something that involves doing nothing. And they find themselves just daydreaming, right? The mind just goes quiet. So that's a natural occurrence of the states that yoga encourages. Yoga has tools that help you get there, which is convenient. You don't have to go on a vacation and hope that state comes about. Instead, you can do the practice and cultivate that state. And when the concentration becomes effortless, your mind goes through a shift where the emphasis of your mental activity isn't pointing or reflecting, is maybe a nice way to say it, a way that Wendy said it this morning in her lecture. It isn't reflecting just the sensory data, just the outside world. Instead, the intellect of your mind can reflect upon the unbound quality, that consciousness quality of who you are instead. And when it does that, there's a shift in your knowing of what's going on. I want to thank everybody who is a sponsor of Peter's podcast on Patreon. Patreon is a cool crowdsourcing, crowdfunding site that I use to make it possible to have Peter's podcast without advertisements. So many of the podcasts I love to listen to stop right in the middle and sell me a mattress or sell me a watch or sell me some food service. I'm just like constantly fast-forwarding through that stuff. I hope that I can avoid doing that in Peter's podcast, but it requires some funding from folks like you who enjoy this content and are willing to, say, spend the price of a cappuccino on it or even less. So if that's you, sounds like it's worth doing, please check it out, patreon.com/peterspodcast, and you can subscribe for any amount you like. Some of my sponsors are getting a session with me every month where we talk for an hour online, or getting a mantra from me, or just dropping a buck here and there to make it possible. You can always start, stop, change the amount. So it's super easy. Thank you. Patreon.com/Peter's Podcast. So in this final stage, the final limb, which goes by the Sanskrit name Samadhi, you have what gets called immersion or merging or transcendence. But the confusing aspect of these descriptions is that because there's consciousness that we're using all the time, our awareness, and that's there in samadhi as well, it's different from sleep, you don't go unconscious, it can be kind of confusing. It's like, well, all I do, I'm just sitting here. But if you allow that just sitting there to be enough, then when you have left that just sitting there, that just being, letting the thoughts that come be dismissed until there aren't so many thoughts, till there's a feeling of spaciousness, till there's a sense of timelessness, till there's no connection with being in your body, and that sustains for longer and longer the more you practice. If you do that for 15, 18, 20 minutes, even if you do it for 5 minutes, if that's as much as you can muster, when you're back in your day, you start to notice changes in your life. You start to notice amazing things happen. And one of the things that I focused on in the retreat is that we can access that kind of transformative tapping in all the time if we do it, you know, if we take the moment to do it. So let me say that a different way. If you meditate and you get to know what this feeling is like, and you also start to learn how to transition in and out of that state, very interesting things happen as you're going from the place of concentration to that effortless concentration to that samadhi, sort of the thoughts stopping and then just becoming content with being there. Interesting things happen in terms of understanding more about living, more about what life's about, more about understanding some kind of a relationship thing that's going on, more about something in the world. And if you do any reading, the thoughts or observations of great thinkers, Virginia Woolf, Albert Einstein, Gustav Mahler, they talk about this shift of something, that there's a thing, there's a something happening, that I'm not doing it, I'm like receiving it, or it's dawning on me, right? Dave Chappelle was being interviewed by Jerry Seinfeld recently, and they were talking about coming up with material for their stand-up. And Chappelle said, yeah, you know, it's like I get an idea And it's like, yahoo, we're driving the car now, we're going somewhere, you know? But like, sometimes the idea is driving and I'm riding shotgun. Sometimes I'm just in the trunk and the idea's doing everything. Because what gets messed up is when I get like cocky and I'm trying to drive the car and there's no idea there, then it never works. So people who are creative, people who are, you know, breaking the boundaries of the normal of how we're thinking, they are aware of this stuff. And they are able to, many of them have expressed it. Some of them, you know, don't know how, it's not their forte, or their self-study doesn't really go into that kind of philosophical realm. But it's pretty consistent that you hear about this sense of this idea came to me. So if you get good at navigating that transitional space between mindlessness as well as mindfulness, right? That space between where I concentrate, but then I let myself go effortless, and then the effortless leaves me in this place of spaciousness, of not doing, of just being. If you get good at being in those three transition spaces to where you can sort of have them all happen, they happen like instantaneously among themselves, then in your day-to-day, in your I'm busy working on something and suddenly there's a challenge, suddenly I can't figure it out, suddenly I need an idea, oh my God, what am I going to do? You can take a moment and reach that place for yourself. Practice allowing that insight to come. So the method for doing that could be some kind of a ritual. Maybe you call something to mind that helps remind you of what it's like to be in that state. Sometimes it's just taking a couple of breaths. Sometimes it's closing your eyes. Whatever it is, you can just do it. I remember being in a teacher training, and one of the students asked me a question. And I just paused, because it wasn't something I had a ready answer for. I paused, and then I said the answer. And like instantaneously, one of the other students said, "Where did you just go? I just saw you go somewhere. How did you do that? What is that?" So this is what I'm talking about. Like, I could barely even tell him what I was doing. It was just that I was accustomed to allowing the answer. So in this practice, which goes by the Sanskrit name of samyama, you find a moment, do whatever you need. Probably there's a breath involved, taking a breath, taking a step outside of the current circumstances, right? If you're engaged in an argument, for instance, it's that willingness to give up your position for a moment and see what's really going on here. And in that question, in that giving up, that you know the answer with existing information, then other information can come in. And when you do that, then do it, act, right? Do the action that came to you. In Einstein's case, you know, write the formula down. Right? In Virginia Woolf's case, be part of the music of the universe, and so on. And then grow in your trusting of that, right? And you grow in your trusting of that by also being a little skeptical, right? You try something and you go, is this going to work? So you try it, and you don't just be like, some sometimes you see on Instagram this sense that, if only you're positive, everything will be great, right? Well, that's not exactly true, right? Being positive is sometimes preferable to being negative, but being honest and true and having good discernment, clarity, you know, those things are more valuable, so that you're not deluding yourself, or you're not fooling yourself, or you're not just being optimistic with no justification, where you need to take some action, right, in order to actually get the results you're after. So the more that you do that, the more that you use the method, test the result against your own healthy skepticism, but not mess with the result. In other words, go ahead and take the action and trust, and then, you know, evaluate over time. Then you start to realize, you know what, this stuff is really helping me. I feel more confident. I feel like I do know something. I feel like when I need an answer, I can get the answer. And so that building of your own confidence is like a tapping into your own genius. You know, it's like we think of Einstein as a genius. We think of Virginia Woolf as a genius. You know, we think of, the people we admire as somehow being special. But very often they just have a great skill at tapping into their own brilliance. But we all have a brilliance. We all have a unique vision. We all have the capability of transcending the ordinary and then bringing that to bear on our lives. So because we're such a celebrity culture, we often will just say, I'll never be Beyonce, you know. But who cares? Like, if you're able to sing for your own child and it makes them happy, that's a brilliance too, you know. If you write songs for your own joy, that's brilliance, you know. Wherever it's expressing, wherever your life is in need of some creativity or something to boost you out of your ordinary way of dealing things, to help you get unstuck, to help you move out of an eddy that's caught you behind a rock. You can call on your own brilliance, your own genius, your own unique ways to make something happen. And sometimes when you do that, not only does it help you see that you are more than you anticipated, more than you expected, more than you ever were aware of, it also helps you see other people differently. It helps you see that they are like you. They're doing the best they can with the best tools they have available to them. And when they're doing something that seems like it's about you, often it has nothing to do with you, but it maybe caught you before in a certain way. It triggered something in you. You felt threatened or traumatized or something. But now that you have this other perspective, now that you're willing to get some perspective, to shift the energy, to move out, to inquire or invite more intelligence into it, of a different kind even, suddenly, wow, you know what? What's this about? In our retreat, we were talking about circumstances where people were like in mortal danger, and, you know, through a kind of a taking a breath, we're able to diffuse the situation. So it's incredibly powerful. So I would invite you to think about your own yoga and how you're approaching it, and to maybe start looking at how can I expand. So if you're only doing asana, how can I also do some work with my breath? If you're doing asana and you're doing some work with your breath, how can I also work with this notion of doing a little bit of stillness, a little bit of concentrating. If you find you're too disturbed to do any concentrating, take a look at, how am I living my life? Am I hoarding things? Am I sort of stealing in a way? Whether it's, I'm probably not like stealing like a burglar, but am I stealing time from other people? Am I, you know, not treating myself well? Am I not being kind? Am I being violent in some way or form? You know, and what are the gifts to myself if I try to avoid that way of acting? What does that leave me with? So to do a little self-study around that, to do a little more things that help me feel better, a little less of things that make me feel worse, and then try, can I concentrate now? Can I get quiet now? Can I be even still to the point where I lose this connection, this, like, this is all there is, connection with the outside world, and instead start to allow insight, inspiration, and my own brilliance to come shine through. And we have words that describe that. They always sound kind of wacko or poetic or, you know, out there. But a word like enlightenment, at its essence, is just about, yeah, I can see a little better because there's some light on the situation, right? So maybe in an interaction with someone, having a little more light on the situation helps you see it for what it is. So I hope that's useful, and I invite you to always drop me a line, ask questions. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you would support me on patreon.com. Patreon is a way that I fund the podcast. It's the only way I fund the podcast. You can go to patreon.com/peterspodcast and subscribe. So what that means is to become a patron. You sign on to support me for some amount every month. Certain levels get you a bonus, so you can check out and see if there's a bonus you like. And then each month, Patreon will bill you that amount. You can always stop. You can always make it more if you decided, oh my gosh, this is worth so much more to me. If you are in a financial jam and you need to stop, you can always change it. All right? So thank you. And from Breteuil in the middle of Normandy, where there are cows in my next yard over, there are ducks behind me, and everyone is eating croissant every morning, I wish you a beautiful day. Namaste.